1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Talk Spock, the podcast that explores what's the deal with Dr. Benjamin Spock. How did baby and child care become the preeminent parenting guide of the 20th century? Who gets to tell parents how to parent? I'm Deborah.
And I'm Katie. We're talking Spock because we want to understand what it is about Dr. Spock's work that endures. Why is the Spock brand around 25 years after Dr. Spock died?
In this episode of Spock Talk, we're going to cover how Dr. Benjamin Spock introduced psychoanalytic concepts to the American public by sneaking Freudian concepts into baby and child care. But first, we're going to talk about how the Rockefeller Foundation primed the conditions for Spock's Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care to be a once-in-a-century sensation. I want to talk a little bit about how psychology was used as a tool for social control, so relative to other academic disciplines in the early 20th century, psychology was fresh, new, fashionable. For example, Virginia Woolf and her modernist contemporaries were including references to Freud in literature because it was the popular thing to do.
So I know that this would be a good place for me to make some comment about Virginia Woolf and her works, but I'm embarrassed to say that I can't because I've never, ever read any Virginia Woolf. And you can go on and mock me and call me out on my ersatz intellectualism, but I have absolutely nothing to say about To the Lighthouse unless you will allow me to guess. Is The Lighthouse a penis?
I believe that she was asked about it, and she said, sometimes a lighthouse is just a lighthouse.
Oh, well, that's enlightening.
So this is semi-related to our last episode when we talked about how in this time period there was a great deal of interest in using science, and I'm loosely defining science, to improve, and I'm also loosely defining improve society. There were folks who saw potential for psychology to solve social problems like poverty. And there has been this grand American tradition of wealthy elites using money and influence in a paternalistic way, like the Carnegie Libraries, for example. I think the general perception of Carnegie Libraries is they're great. This obscenely wealthy guy built all of these cute little libraries so that people could read books. Wasn't that nice and generous? But the true motivation was a bit more, let's say, economically motivated than that. Carnegie thought that if the hoi polloi, the working class, could have access to knowledge in the same way that rich people had access to knowledge, society would have a better workforce, which is right, but it's not a completely altruistic undertaking.
Right. And this goes on even now with so-called corporate responsibility initiatives. Is it bad that a giant corporation wants to fund the pool renovations at a local community center? No, of course not. Summer is coming and people need that pool. But it's not an entirely altruistic act for the corporation to want to be seen as contributing positively to its workers' communities in this way. It improves their image and helps paper over minor complaints from the workforce.
That's a good example. Katie, have you heard of the Rockefellers?
Well, Deborah, as someone who dwells on a coast, albeit not one of the elite ones, I am familiar with how they cook oysters. And I also know that John D. Rockefeller was some sort of titan of industry in the early 1900s, maybe? That's all I've got.
I am thinking of the 1920s when the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Foundation spent millions of dollars to try and standardize child raising by setting up centers and universities that would train home economists and teachers to be parent educators. They took psychological theories and distilled them into pamphlets for mothers. And in creating this parent education movement, the Rockefeller Foundation also at the same time created demand for parenting education. and the precedent for infusing psychology into parenting literature. My point is that Spock was not the first author to sneak psychology into parenting education lit, but his book became very mainstream and widely read in comparison to the Rockefeller pamphlets.
So how does this happen?
Okay, Jane, Spock's first wife, is the family member who got into psychoanalysis. She developed an interest in psychology when she was a student at Bryn Mawr College. And then when she was putting Spock through medical school, she worked for a guy named Dr. George Draper, taking patient medical histories for his research. And it was Dr. Draper who encouraged Jane to get psychoanalyzed, which seems like a weird thing for a boss to recommend to their employee.
Okay, so not only because of the last name Draper, but I cannot hear this story without remembering that episode of Mad Men where Betty Draper's psychiatrist called her husband Don to discuss her sessions. Please tell me this analyst wasn't reporting back to Dr. Draper or Dr. Spock.
Not to Dr. Spock. He very much felt that what happened on the couch, on the analyst's couch, stayed on the analyst's couch.
So enlightened.
He didn't get involved in Jane's therapy treatment, but he did, like, she did it her whole life, pretty much. She just never quit psychoanalysis. It was very distressing for her, too, because it brought up all of these painful childhood memories. Her father, very shamefully for the family, died of syphilis when she was 13 years old. And before he died, he was psychotic and verbally abusive, because that's what happened to people who had syphilis before antibiotics.
So let me pull back the curtain a little bit on this podcast and just let our listeners know that sometimes you put little prompts in here for me for things you want me to talk about. And here you asked me to provide some syphilis jokes. And I've already failed you once with my lack of sparkling Virginia Woolf commentary. And now I just have to disappoint you again and say that I don't have any syphilis jokes.
Well, I assigned it to you because I didn't either. So it's no problem at all. Both of the young Spocks then, Ben and Jane, were into psychology. After Spock's pediatrics residency in 1931, he completed another residency in psychiatry at the Payne Whitney Clinic at the New York Hospital Cornell. But he was discouraged by this residency because he didn't get to work with pediatric patients very often. And he observed that the best staff, in his opinion, had Freudian psychoanalytic training. In 1932, when he was trying to get his pediatric practice going, he realized there wasn't any psychological training specifically for pediatricians in New York. Nobody was blending those specialties, and he saw that as an opportunity and a selling point because the parents in his socioeconomic sphere were reading about psychology in popular magazines, and he thought if he trained in both disciplines, he would be able to distinguish himself in the marketplace. He did eventually get board certified in pediatrics, but he never got board certified in psychiatry. In 1933, he was a student at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute, like in the evenings, and he underwent a year of psychoanalysis with Bertram Lewin and 5 years of seminars, two a week. In his memoir, he wrote about how he complained endlessly about his mother's criticalness and domination for several months, but it was a rush of forgotten memories of his father's emotional absence that was the light bulb moment when he decided to blend psychoanalysis and pediatrics. So Spock knew that psychoanalysis was all about diagnosing and treating trauma that had occurred in childhood or infancy. So deep-seated trauma, the Freudians believed, was caused by things like putting a baby's hands in aluminum mitts or tying a baby's wrists to the sides of the crib in order to stop them from sucking their thumb.
Okay, hang on. I was lucky enough to not have any thumb suckers, but I do have a 7-year-old who cannot keep his hands out of his mouth because his teeth are wiggly now. So these are some seriously genius ideas. Aluminum mitts all the way. I'm sure they won't traumatize him.
Oh my gosh. Our family dentist shamed my thumb-sucking child out of it, which a Freudian would see that as detrimental to a developing human's oral stage.
I mean, better the dentist shame him than you do it. So that's one that you escaped.
True. They can talk about the dentist on the psychoanalyst's couch in another decade. Spock recognized that this Freudian way of looking at development paired very nicely with the routine questions from parents about toilet training, thumb sucking, pacifiers, and weaning. And he believed that he was preventing psychological problems that would often begin in childhood. Let's listen to an audio clip of Dr. Benjamin Spock speaking about the influence of Freud on the reassuring tone he achieved in baby and child care.
I think it's wonderful that the book can be reassuring when it's expressed ideally. From my point of view, the parent says, it feels as if you're talking to me and as if you think I'm a sensible person, and it's given me enormous comfort on many occasions. And I glow with pride and tears almost come to my eyes. So I think that this is the first and the main effect of the book is to reassure parents. It gives them some factual information also. Now I think in addition, at a more subtle level, what it has done is to reassure parents that their children are trying to grow up to be more mature, more responsible people, and that this has made it less necessary for parents to keep after their children, scold them, act disapproving or mistrustful of them. I think that this just wasn't the influence of myself. I think it was the influence of Freud's writings, who emphasized love rather than punishment or repression. It was the influence of John Dewey, the educational philosopher, who said, children don't have to be forced to learn, children want to learn. In other words, Freud, Dewey, and Spock have all been saying, you can trust your children to a large degree.
Psychology heads will recognize some of these names. Spock learned from Carolyn Zachary, who had been a student of John Dewey. She was into progressive education, which is like project-based learning instead of rote memorization. Spock also became friends with Margaret Mead and Eric Erickson. And in the late 1930s and 1940s, Spock treated mostly upper middle class, highly educated families in New York City. He was the pediatrician to a lot of children of psychoanalysts, psychologists, social workers, including sort of famously Margaret Mead's daughter. And then this is just a side bit of information. Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary was his patient when she was a child.
Aww. So that is an extremely famous client list. Margaret Mead was an anthropologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how successful Spock was trying to marry up Freud's extremely Eurocentric theories with any multicultural beliefs Margaret Mead may have picked up. I'm kind of wishing I could have been a fly on that wall.
Totally. Spock went through another year of psychoanalysis for himself with an analyst named Sandor Rado, who was the most assertive therapist in the city. These sessions really changed Spock's philosophy about child rearing. Up until then, Spock and Jane were strict parents with their first son, Michael, using the same Holt-style strict scheduling that Spock's mother had used, but their son John, who was born on April 20th, 1944, was raised. Well, I don't think Ben and Jane were the best parents IRL, but John Spock was raised in a slightly more nurturing and compassionate way instead of that Holtian follow the schedule kind of way.
It's a real do as I say, not as I do sort of situation then.
Completely. He took all of his psychoanalysis education and experience, and then he disguised it in baby and child care. He never mentioned Freud at all. His biographer Mayer writes, masking Freudian theory in friendly phrases and American colloquialisms proved to be one of the most masterful aspects of Spock's book. The psychological reasons for children's behavior were put forth like the acquired wisdom of a Yankee country doctor, not like a man who had been psychoanalytically trained and twice analyzed by Freudians immigrated from Europe. Dr. Spock knew that Americans were too puritanical and conservative for Freud. It's so sneaky. I love it.
Well, Spock knew it was all about the packaging. I mean, remember him in his dapper suits?
Mm-hmm. So he believed in Freud's theory of an oral stage, and he advocated for making feeding an enjoyable experience. So, quote-unquote, on-demand feeding, which is a concept that we've both read about in contemporary baby books. The logic behind that is Freudian.
Well, maybe to Spock, but my crunchy parenting books also taught me that on-demand feeding was how our ancestors did it. I mean, our way back ancestors, the good ones, not the ones who were tying our hands to the crib bars, but maybe the same ones who invented the paleo diet?
Maybe. Toilet training is another example of where Spock was able to fit in the Freudian stuff without naming it. He took a very chill and casual approach to toilet training, contrasting with his forebears like Holt. Spock wrote, "I don't think there's any one right time or way to toilet train." He goes on to talk about how what's right for one child might not work for the next, and it should really be up to the parents. It's kind of good advice for anything, really.
Agreed.
Penis envy and castration anxiety are other Freudian concepts included in baby and child care, which Spock addressed as just describing how a little girl might wonder why their bodies looked differently than, say, their brothers. And castration anxiety is expressed oppositely, like little boys might wonder why girls don't have penises. Okay, so Freud described regression as an emotional defense mechanism, and Spock describes this as a child feeling jealous and acting out, like when the parents have a new baby. Basically, I get the sense that Spock was trying to remove shame because shame leads to repression, which the Freudians would consider to be a negative thing, and leads to inflexible, fussy adults. Spock acknowledged feelings in a way that was pretty groundbreaking for the time period. I don't really know anything about Freud, but I know that his psychoanalysis is sometimes referred to as the talking cure. So Spock wrote, "A child is happier around parents who aren't afraid to admit their anger because then he can be more comfortable about his own. And justified anger that's expressed tends to clear the air and leave everyone feeling better. I am talking not about being rough on children, but about admitting your feelings."
Okay, all this sounds very reasonable coming from Spock, but I just have to push back on the Freudian influence based on everything that I know about Freud, which granted only comes from two intro level anthropology and sociology courses I did in undergrad a million years ago, taught by men who never, ever, ever once brought up Freud's problematic attitudes about women. So, it's kind of difficult to square Spock being a devotee of Freud with a true respect for the women he was advising. Take the whole concept of penis envy, as I understand it. So the male body, complete with penis, is nature's norm. Women don't have a penis, so once a girl realizes that her body is abnormal, she envies those with penises and even feels shame at her body's inherent lack. Castration anxiety comes from a boy's realization that girls don't have penises and his fear that were he to lose his, he would become like them, abnormal and deficient. So, the very idea about penis envy and castration anxiety seems to go a far bit beyond Spock's simple statement of a realization that boys and girls' bodies are different.
Mm-hmm.
I came across this total time capsule of a New York Times article from 1971 called "The Femme Lib Case Against Sigmund Freud," which, whew, that's the headline for the ages. Okay, so the male author describes this as the prevailing male view of Freud at the time. Freud, quote, wished to preserve the achievements of human nature against its own destructive tendencies, end quote. This was a fundamentally conservative act, quote, but the act was on the side of freedom, a Promethean blow against obscuritanism and cultural darkness, end quote. So since he's trying to figure out what feminists so dislike about Freud in writing this article, he goes on to state, what struck me most when I went back to read Freud was not so much the hundreds of disparaging references to women scattered throughout his works. It is that Freud's entire theory of sexuality is built from a masculine model. In psychoanalysis, maleness is the norm and femaleness an incomplete or even worse, deficient aspect of it. Even motherhood, which we understandably think of as a unique female capacity and accomplishment, is indissolubly linked in Freudian thought with women's inferiority to man. For the woman has never really given up her longing to have a penis. The sexual energy of females can only be released by the actuality or felt potentiality of giving birth, an act by which the penis is symbolically attained. To give birth to a son is the most complete symbolical appropriation. Yikes.
Seriously.
Maybe it's asking too much to wonder how Freud's ideas about the inferiority of womankind could seep into Spock's simple guide to so-called common sense child-rearing issues.
No, I think that's totally right on. I should clarify earlier when I said that I loved that Spock sneaked Freudian theory into his book. It's the sneaking that I admire. It's not the Freud theories that I admire. So the first couple of editions of Baby and Child Care were very sexist and very two-dimensional about male roles and female roles. And we will get into it with the gender binary and misogyny next time. What? So listeners, subscribe so you don't miss it.
So did people at the time know that Freud was in Baby and Child Care?
So Freud followers were very excited about Spock's book, but book reviewers and Spock himself never talked when it was first published about how the advice was heavily influenced by psychoanalysis theories. This is quite a bit later in Spock's career when he was teaching at Western Reserve University in Ohio. And I read that Anna Freud, or it's probably Anna Freud, daughter of Sigmund, visited the university to give a lecture, and she praised Spock's book. A colleague observed that they had similar writing styles and that they were able to explain complex notions in understandable terms. Later on, Spock's book was criticized for not being based on science enough, which we've talked about, and for not accounting for the role of genetics, for being too anecdotal. And in defense of Spock a little bit, instructional books without anecdotes are super boring.
Agree.
Later on, in the 1950s and 60s, Spock wrote a lot of popular magazine articles, and he kept on spreading Freudian concepts there, like sibling rivalry and the Oedipus complex. And another interesting thing about Baby and Child Care is that it became a model for self-help books. There was a very popular self-help book titled Passages, which was big in the 70s, I guess. And the author, Gail Sheehy, explicitly told readers that it was patterned on Spock's famous child development manual. The 1985 edition of Baby and Child Care included more advice about psychological issues. There was a lot less sugarcoating of the psychoanalytic theory. It was straightforward. Which makes sense because by then the American public had had like 50 years to grow accustomed to psychology as a framework for seeing the world.
I know of Freud from sociology classes, but I never took any psychology. So is it true that we wouldn't have good old run-of-the-mill CBT talk therapy without Freud, or is that just good marketing?
I don't even know what CBT stands for.
Cognitive behavioral therapy. That's like your classic therapy that everyone does now, right?
I'm not the person to answer
this question. We are getting out over our skis. Okay, so like your run-of-the-mill person can throw out terms like Oedipal complex or talk about the superego without really grasping the details of either of these concepts. That run-of-the-mill person is me, by the way. And they can still understand that those concepts, A, came from Freud, and B, are somehow capital I important ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Reading more about his theories now, though, they don't seem revolutionary. They seem overwrought and pretty obviously based in notions of society and the world that we now consider to be at best quaint and at worst just fully wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. I did think psychoanalysis was sort of dead and irrelevant and has been replaced by more evidence-based therapy techniques, but there was pretty... Earlier this year, there was an article in the New York Times style section about a resurgence in psychoanalysis. And that, too, talked about how some concepts like denial and libido all have origins in Freudian theory, but we have just sort of absorbed those into our common vernacular. We don't even think of them as psychology concepts necessarily.
Gotcha. I'm still not really sure how to feel about that. Okay, but back to our original question. Why was the Spock brand so enduring? Did the sneaky inclusion of Freudian concepts help to popularize Spock's work?
I think that the pop psychology style of writing had more to do with its popularity than the actual concepts themselves. Going back to Anna Freud's praise and influence for a moment, I really think that this is an incredible strength of the Freuds and the Freud followers. I'm surely not the first person to ever observe this, but writing in an approachable conversational style is a really effective way to get people to read books.
Deborah, that's a really funny comment because you and I have notoriously different tastes in books. I used to be such an insufferable snob about books, but I've recently embraced reading books that are actually enjoyable, and I can heartily recommend it. I definitely want to know the love stories of all 8 Bridgerton siblings, and I want to know all the sneaky things the Masons are up to.
Before we wrap up, let's go to a segment we call New Spock, Old Spock. In this segment, we'll take a look at early Spock advice and see what has changed since the mid-1900s. Since we mentioned infant feeding in the oral stage, here's a passage from the OG Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, first edition published in 1946, about mixing formula. In the terminal method, you sterilize the bottles after the formula is in them. In the aseptic method, you boil the formula in a container and then pour it into sterilized bottles. In the aseptic method, you strain the scum off the boiled milk as you pour it into the bottles. You can buy a funnel with a built-in strainer. Katie, what do later editions say about mixing formula and straining the scum?
All right, so there are no straight-up references to scum in the 10th edition, but... In the section on sterilizing, which is a lot shorter and less involved in the 10th edition because there's this maybe misplaced assumption that everyone has a reliably clean water supply, they do direct you, if you need more information on sterilization, to drspock.com, in which they have some passages from the 9th edition of the book that they've cut out from the 10th edition, but they figure might still be useful. So on drspock.com, it says... Well, drspock.com is where you finally get the scum. So after going into more detail about the terminal sterilization process, it says, quote, there will be less clogging of the nipple holes when the formula is allowed to cool slowly for an hour or two without being shaken at all. This will allow any scum to form into one large firm piece, which will then stick to the inside of the bottle. Yum.
Okay. One, thank you so much for that dogged research into scum references. I would have stopped at the 10th edition. And two, I think that formula scum is due for a rebrand. Yuck.
I know, that's got to be where all the nutrients are, right? It's like the roughage. You remember how your mom used to tell you to always eat the crusts of your bread because that's where the roughage was?
Yeah, or it's like buckwheat, which is like a byproduct, basically.
No, that's a way better way to market it. It's like the cream on the top of the milk of the non-real milk world. $1 million idea. Don't steal it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Spock Talk. Please subscribe so you are sure to get our next episode, in which we'll explore Dr. Benjamin Spock's misogyny in his writing.
I, for one, cannot wait. See this episode's show notes for our references. If you like what you're hearing, give us a like or a share on social media. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Listen to our other podcast, It's My Screen Time Too, where we review TV shows and movies made for kids.
Special thanks to the WNYC Archive Collections. We'll see you soon the next time we talk Spock.
Spock Talk, Spock Talk, Spock Talk. Spock Talk, Spock Talk, Spock Talk, Spock Talk.